everybody, welcome to the April podcast of Radio Ireland Days, and I'm really thrilled to be here with multi-talented, hilarious lady called Eleanor Tiernan, who's a comedian. You're a professional comedian.
I am, Valerie. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
How long are you a professional comedian?
That's a funny kind of a question. I did my first stand-up gig in September 2004, and I was kind of in college at the time, but I suppose I went professional really when I went on tour with Tommy Tiernan.
Okay.
In 2007, so I've been professional about 5 years.
Crikey! And does it feel good to write that on an application form and stuff and go, "That's what I do for a living"?
I don't tend to put it down on things.
No.
I don't know what jobs I'd be. Maybe for tax, really, would be the only thing I'd be trying to.
Fair enough.
Have to declare it. I had to do it for going into America before I put my address or my occupation down on it, and I said I would never do it again, actually, because they immediately got suspicious that I was going working America. So I said I'll never put that down again.
Mad.
I'll say I'm an actor the next time.
Okay, because you do a lot of acting in what it is, you know, in your profession, so I'll go down to that in a minute, but like becoming a comedian is probably one of the most daunting tasks in the world, isn't it? Would you think?
I suppose if you haven't done it, it probably looks like that. But you don't think I'm going to become a comedian. You just think I'm going to do a gig at the start. It's kind of incremental. You become a comedian by doing gigs. Okay. So I didn't think I'm going to become a comedian. I thought I'm going to do a stand-up comedy gig. I think I'd enjoy doing that. And then you do it, and then you go, "Oh God, I think I'll do that again."
Okay.
And then you go, "I'm becoming fascinated by this. How do you do it? How do you do it really well?" And then you just do. That was my way, was just to do more and more and more of it. And
so there's no real way of training only by doing it. Is that what
exactly?
You mean?
It's kind of. It's nearly. It's more akin to being. There's more an apprenticeship to it rather than. A kind of a professionalism, like being a doctor or something like that. Doctors know when they're qualified.
Yeah.
Comedians just do it, like just very gradually become more skilled at what they're doing.
And would you find that with every single gig you do, you get that little bit more confidence? Or is it up and down?
Up and down, but over time, gradually, you obviously become more kind of hardened to it, I think. Mm. You become more less threatened, less situations happen that can throw you. So, for example, you might go, the first time you walk into a stand-up comedy club and you see that there's a hen party in the audience, the first time that happens, you go, "Oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? What if they won't pay attention to me? Or what if, you know, they're on their own thing?" But then, you only have to face it the first time once, and then it gradually becomes less intimidating, and then not intimidating at all, and then gradually becomes actually something you embrace, those kind of things.
Like, because heckling is something that can be terrifying, I'm assuming, right?
It frightened me for a long time now. I was quite worried that somebody would shout something out that I wouldn't have an answer for. And then a lot of comedians will use kind of stock put-downs. Like, there's kind of things that every comedian shares. So, like, for example, if somebody shouts out something random, the comedian might say, "Oh, it's great to see them out and about in the community."
Thing. Brilliant.
That's something. And sometimes they come to mind, but actually I don't really like using them because I don't feel they're... If you're using lines that anybody can use, it's not really original to yourself. So I prefer to just...
Improvise, is it?
Improvise, yeah. If I can think of something, I do it. And if I don't, then, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Am I correct in thinking that audiences are a little more kind to women regarding heckling, you know?
I don't know, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, because they can really go for it with the men, can't they?
I don't really notice much of a difference, to be honest now.
Okay, cool. I heard you've been interviewed on Radio 1 there a few months ago, and you actually trained as a civil engineer, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. That was the first college thing I did.
Yeah, and like that's quite a jump away to what you're doing now. Like,
it is, but there is actually logic to it in that my dad is an engineer, and it is a very familiar thing for me in one way, engineering and I suppose all the language around that and the kind of jobs that engineers would do.
Okay.
So it's quite a safe choice for me to take on going into college.
Yeah, okay.
Because I actually did the same exact same college course that my dad did. So I was really just like not challenging myself personally at the time. I think I just took an easy option and did that, and then got bored very quickly when I was trying to work at it.
Yeah.
Not bored in that it wasn't it wasn't challenging. It is, it's very challenging, but for me, I was interested in, I had different interests than it, so it was just kind of became more difficult to keep doing.
Yeah, how long did you stay doing that for then?
I was 6 years working at engineering.
Yeah. And I heard on the show too that you took a sabbatical and then went back for, is it 8 days, is it?
I know, yeah, that's what happened. I took a 5 year kind of career break from this. It was a government job that I had at the time. And you have to keep renewing your career break every year. You don't take 5 years at once, just 1 year at a time. Got to the end of the 5 years and it became time to go, I'm either going to, you know, you have to either resign completely or else go back. And I didn't have the, I didn't have the clarity in my mind to know what to do.
Yeah.
So I went back, and then very quickly it became really clear to me what I had to do, which was that I just wasn't able to do the job anymore.
Yeah. Fair play to you for doing that. That takes guts.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, but it was kind of more instinctual as well, you know. It was more guts at the start, really, I think, to kind of take the initial career break, then, because once I had kind of crossed a line at that when I went back the second time.
Like, I would consider the style, your style of comedy would, in my opinion, be on stage. Firstly, would be kind of deadpan. Would it be kind of deadpan stuff?
Yeah.
So, and how do you keep a straight face?
I suppose you just kind of try and stay a bit grounded and. I prefer not to give any clue to the fact that I'm joking about things.
Yeah, okay.
That's the kind of comedy I would like to see.
Yeah.
I don't know how I keep a straight face. I just try and, you know, keep a bit of self-control.
Because I do like that type of comedy. And that's why when you were on the afternoon show, you know, doing that infamous, the sausage gate is what it's called, being called now, I think. Like, do you think that the host of the show thought that you were serious?
Yeah, I think they just kind of weren't clued into the fact that I was a comedian. Because when I'm in a comedy club, like, all the signs are there.
Mm.
She's a comedian. She's on the stage in a comedy club.
Yeah.
She has to be joking about, you know, that people have that. There's a context for it. While it was slightly out of context on the what I told a joke on the Today Show.
Yeah.
And it kind of... in a way, I kind of feel a bit, not that it was a big deal for them, I'm sure, for Dahi and Maura, but like, they kind of looked at, people were trying to make them out to look foolish in it. And really, all that happened was I just did a joke that died on its arse on the television. And then it looked like I was trying to, you know, wreck the Today Show or something like that. That's not what happened.
Yeah.
I just failed as a comedian.
Well, it went on YouTube. And I looked it up before I came here. It's had over 150,000 hits on YouTube.
Oh, my God.
Imagine.
Bloody
hell. Like, so, like, that's... It was worth doing in one way.
Yeah, maybe it's one person watching over and over again, though.
I would get worried about whoever that is, actually.
Yeah.
So, like, as well as doing the deadpan thing, like, I've seen you on some fantastic shows, The Savage Eye, Irish Pictorial Weekly, like, and you play a lot of characters as well. So not only do you have the deadpan, in my opinion, right, but you also have this wacky, mad women that you play, like Terry Prone and Joan Burton and stuff like that. So do you find that, am I correct in thinking you've got two types of comedy that you use?
I never thought of it that way. I suppose whatever the job calls for, I try and do my best at it, really.
Yeah.
I don't feel kind of that comfortable doing wacky stuff in my stand up.
Okay.
Actually, while if there's a script and I see it as an acting job, I feel much more comfortable doing kind of mad as you say, mad kind of faces, pulling faces and things and that.
Because you're brilliant at it.
Oh, thank you.
It's like the minute you put a wig on or a costume or whatever, it's like, it's crazy stuff. I love it. Like, you know, the stuff that you do with the Savage Eye and particularly Irish Pictorial Weekly, do you write the material for that?
I do a lot of it, but but it's not really, there's no kind of method to that. It's a whole pool of, there's about 6 or 7 writers that are putting in stuff. So you could, by chance, end up doing something that you wrote yourself, or you could end up playing a part. We were under such pressure with Irish Pictorial Weekly that I was out filming some things on a day, and then they'd need somebody for another sketch later on in the day, and just because I was there, I ended up doing it.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of the stuff isn't that kind of well planned in that way, you know.
But it doesn't seem like it. It seems very well thought out, actually.
Well, I suppose when you're on the fly like that, you know, and under pressure, you know, you just... you don't think about things too much, so it probably comes across that way.
Actually, when you're writing for that, is there a group of you all in a room together, or do you just write it at home in your bedroom?
It'd be a combination of the two things. We'd meet occasionally and throw around ideas and try and be funny in front of one another. I put myself under terrible pressure at the start of the project. I was really trying to be the funniest person in the room, you know, just to kind of prove to everybody that I deserved to be there. And then after a while, once I got to grips with it, I just didn't care anymore. And that was much more productive, actually, after that.
Because you're with your peers and, like, they're pretty amazing
amazing comedians. People, and Paul Howard, and, you know, he's so kind of established, and John Cleary and Colm Tobin as well, and Barry Murphy. Have always, you know, even before I started doing comedy, he's just got a touch of magic fairy dust about him or something.
I read somewhere, now I'm not sure if I'm correct, but that he won't do interviews unless he's in character. Have you heard that?
I've never asked him that now, but actually, now that I think about it, I haven't. I've never seen him do one, so
maybe he is the person. Maybe that is his personality. Who knows?
Yeah.
But like, how did the whole TV stuff come about?
Oh, well, this is the Irish Pictorial Weekly thing. The group started writing together. It was around the general election time 2 years ago. Mm. And RTE had a programme on, and they asked us to write a sketch every day to go on at the end of this programme in the run-up to the election. And it had a political kind of slant to it. So we became like a writer's group, I suppose, that time. And then... it really felt like we were doing something close to what, you know, would happen in America, you know, where you'd have a writer's room for, like, say, Family Guy or Saturday Night Live or those kind of things. And it just became, I would write something and then I'd send it off to the guys or one of the other guys and go, will you read that and take a half a minute out of it? Mm. I don't care what you did, you know, just... Yeah. Cut it down, because the whole thing is to get things shorter and edit them and make them more punchy.
Yeah, so of course.
You just kind of write it and then trust whatever the other person says is that their judgment is.
So do
is
you
good.
Like the whole team dynamic?
I really do, yeah. Really
not
like
surprised.
That.
Not surprised. Is it a lot of fun working on comedy shows?
Really good fun, yeah. I mean, sure, like I just had so much fun when we were filming Irish Pictorial Weekly.
Not surprised. And it got commissioned for another series, didn't it?
We're not 100% sure at the moment, I don't think. It's still, we're kind of acting as if we are, so.
Okay, well, then, turn up someday and then submit it to them. Just hope we get paid, of course.
I think so, yeah.
You know, when the characters that you do, like, say, Terry Prone, do you have to study, like, her voice and footage of her, or do you just make her up into the way you think, oh, this is the way I think Terry Prone is?
I do a good bit of that until I get bored, and then I just go mad with it.
Okay,
So, you know, for the basis of it, you'll kind of try and pick out what aspects of the person you think that you can mimic, and then I end up exaggerating those, I think, is what...
It's brilliant.
So on the day, it probably, you know, it's gone a good bit away from what that actually person
okay,
looks
yeah, I get
sounds
you.
Like, you know.
Like, when you do that lady, is it Ursula McCarthy? Isn't she the newsreader lady?
Yeah,
you do?
Yeah.
How do you remember all those lines. I mean, that's impressive.
I don't, Valerie. What happened? Oh no, she had loads of cuts and takes, and they were getting so, you know, I had to stop loads of times doing
okay.
it. Like, yeah, it was really hard actually.
Okay.
I did get them done. I did get them done in the end, but it was really, really difficult.
Because I'm like going, this woman could be on, like, do the news for real. I mean, you're outside the courthouse and you're like reeling it off. So just show
but
us.
But I've really, like, the girls who actually do that job, like, I think they have to, like, write the stuff.
I know.
Like an hour before it and then do a piece straight to camera. Like, I had 24 hours to learn the script off. Yeah. So. It was easier than what the real girls actually do, I think.
Bloody stressful stuff. Fair play to them.
Yeah.
You know, the material that you have for your own shows, how do you come up with your ideas for that?
It would be mostly things that kind of bother me. I call it a funk about stand-up at the end of last year. I was trying to write an awful lot of material every year and I didn't feel it was kind of true to myself. Don't know if this is the right answer to this question.
Okay, yeah. No, but it's interesting.
Yeah. I come up with stuff. Sometimes an idea isn't enough on its own. It's just a funny little thing. And sometimes a thing is like a big concept and it's a big piece. Mm. And it's trying to figure out, put them all together into, and make a whole act out of it.
Yeah.
So, like, you might observe something funny about the way that, looking at those cups are sitting out. I'm just saying, like, something kind of aesthetic like that. That's not enough for me for a whole piece.
Mm.
For a whole piece, it has to be something kind of... there has to be something maybe like political about it, nearly almost. Like, I'm not talking about politics, like just kind of the way power is in society. That would be a thing that would.
It's more thoughtful, sort of comedy. Yeah.
But then I would need kind of those little tiny observations about the cup dotted along through it in order to kind of sustain people's patience with the topic and with the thought process.
Yeah.
So. You just need ideas from everywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
So do you find that you're walking around and they just pop into your head and you're like, must make a note of that? Or
Yeah.
And is it a long process kind of coming up with a set? Or does it flow out?
That's what I was going to say, a minute ago. When I started off doing comedy, it was my goal. I was thinking, okay, the big guys play Vicar Street. That's what I want to do. So what I'll do now is I'll just start acting like a Vicar Street comedian now in terms of my productivity and my output.
Yeah.
And then when it happens, I'll be all guns blazing. I'll be ready. But actually, for me, comedy hasn't served me well. Or I've found there have been drawbacks to that. And one of them was that trying to write a huge amount of material, I ended up putting in things that I wasn't, that weren't up to scratch. The quality of them wasn't good enough. So then what that does is it weakens the strength of your argument as an artist or a person. If it's not kind of, if what you're saying isn't coherent enough, and if it's not in keeping with your comic persona.
Yeah.
Your comic persona is something really kind of... particular and fine and kind of distilled, and if something seems like something you wouldn't say on stage but you're saying it because it's a funny thing that you thought of, it might suit another comedian better to say it. I was putting those things in when I was trying to keep the quantity of material of, I was trying to write an hour every year, but now what I decided at the end of last year was that I was just going to I wasn't going to put a time limit on myself. I was just going to try and write, and whatever would go into the act would be something that felt really like something Eleanor's comedy persona would say.
Fair play to you.
So that was the way.
Good idea. But yeah, I suppose you only reach that through trying other things. It's like anybody trying anything. Do you find... I mean, you're doing the same... show, I'm assuming. Like, at the moment you're on a 16-date tour around Ireland with Reginald D. Hunter, an American comedian.
Yeah.
16, I know it mightn't be one night in a row, but, like, how do you keep that energy and enthusiasm going for that many nights in a row?
Yeah, you have to do some. I have to do something at the start of every gig to distinguish it from a previous gig. I think there's some kind of barrier that I have to break through within myself to be present in the moment at that gig.
Yeah. So what kind of things might you do then?
I might try a new piece of material. I might veer off the script quite early on in the show, or talk about something that's going on in the room of that particular gig. But trying to think now.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that's, that's loads, I mean, that you do there.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're playing in like big venues like the Cork Opera House, and you're playing in little venues up in the Midlands in Offaly and stuff. Yeah. Which would you prefer size wise?
I don't really mind. I like both. No, okay. I don't really.
Don't have a preference?
No, I don't think so. I suppose the smaller one for me is a little bit more kind of. I feel I have more of an achievement in a small room because when something happens in a small room in a show and you refer to that and you maybe improvise something out of it and it goes well, you can't ignore things happening in the room in a small room. You can in a big room because, like, the person at the top of the balcony won't have heard the thing the person whispered at the front of the room.
Okay,
so
you
actually can't kind of go into dealing with things that happen. While in the smaller room, you're forced to and you have to. Yeah. So it can feel like more like challenging and that you've accomplished more after the show.
Very good. And do you like kind of mingling with the people afterwards, or do you like go, I'm done now, you've had me, I'm spent, I'm going to do my own thing?
I think sometimes it takes me a little bit, my mind kind of races when I come off the stage, so it can take me a little bit of time to be present to people.
Okay.
So I don't like talking to people after the show when my mind is wandering and kind of going back over the show. Don't like kind of, because you don't feel like you're really listening to them, and it's not really fair to be talking to people if you're not listening
to
them properly.
Yeah. That's fair enough. And you've played a ton of festivals like Edinburgh Fringe, isn't it? Galway, Kilkenny Cat Laughs. Is that great crack? You know, I mean, or is that
festivals
hard
are very
work?
Good. I suppose some of them are different to others. The Kilkenny one is very enjoyable to play because most comedians just do a 20-minute set, which is well within anybody's kind of, most of the people that are there, you know, everyone can just do their good 20 that they have at that time, and then you're on with other comedians, so the social aspect of that is nice and good. And I suppose the longer you get into stand-up, the less you see your peers, because they kind of tend to be off doing their own thing.
Really?
When you start off doing stand-up, you're just going into open mic spots all the time, and you're on bills with other comedians, so you end up seeing them a lot. But then the longer you don't, and then at festivals, everyone gets brought back together again. So it's kind of nice. It's a little bit a chance to catch up with
class. People. Are there any comedians now out there that you just absolutely really respect and admire their work?
Yeah.
Loads of them.
I'm really a fan of American comedy. So I'm big into, really like Louis C.K.
Oh, yeah.
I love Bill Burr. It's another guy. It's a guy called Hannibal Buress. Two American ladies called Maria Bamford is brilliant. A girl called Margaret Cho is excellent.
And they're all American comedians.
They're all Americans, yeah. In the UK, then there's Stuart Lee.
Oh yeah,
is brilliant. Tony Law.
Oh my God, I had never seen him until he was on that comedy experience, whatever the alternative comedy experience that you were on, and bloody hell, he's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, like that whole alternative comedy experience, right? Was that like a dream come true to be like somebody you admire, like Stuart Lee, to be on his show and him championing you? You know?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a great kind of validation, to get. You know, he's he's just kind of a world apart, I think.
Total intellectual, and I saw him actually with his Carpet Rem... I can't even pronounce the title of your show. Carpet Remnant something, but it was brilliant.
Yeah. It's
and very, how did you... did he contact you or did you have to put your name forward?
No, contacted me and my agency and then came through me.
Class.
Yeah, me, yeah, so.
And did you meet Tony Law when you were there, actually?
No, I didn't, no, because the shows were filmed one after another, so I was on with two other comedians, two other English comedians, who are brilliant too, Paul Foote and Trevor Locke.
Okay.
They're both two people that would be on that list of brilliance. And
yeah.
I'm mad about Reginald as well, that I'm supporting as well. I think he's...
Brilliant.
He's just... fearless, really thoughtful, but it doesn't kind of pander to any kind of groupthink at all, or you know, the conventional wisdom of the time. He's kind of always challenging that, you know, so you're never kind of really sure, you're kind of like where you are with him in his material, or what stance he's going to take. It's like completely... But it's completely unpredictable, but always really well thought out.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, I find it a very good experience.
That's brilliant. So what advice would you have for anybody else who wants to get into comedy?
The thing I learned, or I kind of came to last year at the end of comedy, is that to get to anything kind of meaningful and, what you know, place where you're proud of and going, oh, I've that was really, you know, really delighted, you know, I stuck around for that. Just take loads of patience. Just have loads of patience and expect to, you know, give yourself room to fail and not do well sometimes. And then, you know, when the time is right, things you know, kind of...
So what drives you to keep doing what you do?
What drives me to keep doing what I do? I don't know, Valerie. I don't know. Yeah.
I suppose maybe like a lot of artists, they just do it because they have to do it because they feel satisfied if they feel miserable if they don't do it, maybe. You often find that with people.
Yeah. I definitely would. I think I'd feel like I was disappearing or something like that if I didn't do it.
Yeah.
That was kind of what kind of happened to me a little bit when I went back to the civil service that time for the 8 days.
Yeah.
I felt like, do you know Back to the Future?
Yeah.
The movie, there's a thing, one of the devices in the movie is Marty McFly has a picture and he's disappearing. Yeah. I felt like I was disappearing from my own picture by being in there.
My God.
So, it wasn't in a way that I had ever, it was like kind of could consciously grasp even, you know, it was just this kind of anxiety and panic
Crikey.
Around it. So I had to end it. And I think life is just less stressful in general if you don't, you know, if you can tap into what gives you, you know, glee, and makes you giddy.
Yeah, it's true, actually, for sure. Like, on your downtime now, what do you like? What would your pastimes be, or what do you like doing for relaxation?
I'm probably a bit pampered in that way. I kind of like going to going for massages and stuff like that.
Oh, cool.
I like meeting friends for coffee and stuff. I do a bit too much of that.
Okay.
You know, I kind of can dawdle away hours
How
when
bad.
I'm not working. Just chatting and gossiping with my friends and stuff about relationships and things.
How bad? That's like fun in itself. I'm sure you might get some material. Although, are friends sometimes afraid that you're going to use some of your conversations in the material?
You see... I've actually tried, it doesn't really work for me to do that kind of thing, but I can take an issue that, like, say some of my friends are all dealing with like one kind of thing in their relationship, I can take that issue and make it about me and then use it, but it doesn't tend to work if I go, well, wait till I tell you about my friend on stage, because it's just not something that my persona would do. It's a little bit too gossipy or something.
Yeah, okay, I understand. And then it's kind of breaking a bit of trust as well, in a way, maybe.
I don't know, I don't care about that.
Do you find that you maybe, because there aren't a huge amount of female comedians, correct? That there aren't a huge amount. would you find that you tend to kind of be gravitate towards each other for support?
I don't know now. I certainly have friends, but I'm not. I know the whole idea of women and art. I would be careful to kind of overstate the importance of gender in it.
Yeah.
To me, the place that kind of humour and writing and thought kind of comes from isn't about gender.
Yeah.
When I'm looking at the comedians I admire, they're it's nothing to do with whether they're male or female. They're from both.
Yeah.
And writers and artists. So I suppose I've friends in comedy that are from both. I do find one of the things, you know, people say things to you after gigs and that, and there's a couple of things. There's one thing that people presume I get really annoyed by, and one of them is when people say, I don't normally like female comedians, but you were very good. Okay. Now, people think that I get really upset by that.
Okay.
But I don't get upset by that at all. Thinking about it, what has actually happened in that person's mind is that they went into a gig with a preconditioned belief, and then you challenge that belief. You have changed. So what's happening is that there's a fight going, there's competition going on in that person's head now.
Yeah.
That they've got two competing ideas, and you know, the battle is going to go on for a little while for them, you know. So they come up, they feel the need to come up and express that to you. They're like, I don't know what to do about that. I've got these two things going on. Give me guidance, you know. Yeah. But you can't, you know.
Does that make you feel good then?
It does. Yeah, I think I think it is good. But there is one thing that really bugs me when people say to me on stage, when I come off stage, is when they say, it's great to see a woman up there.
Okay.
Right, and the reason that bugs me is because I kind of feel that there's an expectation to represent women in some way in what you're doing, and I'm only representing myself.
Okay, what would you think are the benefits of being a comedian? Yeah.
The benefit of being a comedian is that I don't have to get up for a 9-to-5 job, and most of the time I don't have to fake interest in it.
You don't have to fake interest
in the gig that I'm doing.
Oh yeah.
You know, if I was doing a 9-to-5 job, it would be 100% of the time I'd be pretending that I was interested in it. While with comedy, most of the time, I don't have to.
Great, that is the perfect way to end it. Thanks a million, Eleanor, and I am so thrilled to have interviewed you. You're brilliant. Thank you very much, and the best of luck with everything. And I'll be watching out for you on TV and everywhere. Thanks a million.
Valerie.